This week's Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins is brought to you by Squarespace. Make your move with Squarespace. Also, just a reminder that the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
I'm Dee Watkins with Undisclosed, here with The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today I'm joined by my co-host Amelia McDonald Perry.
Hi.
And Todd Oppenheim. Todd has been an advocate as an attorney in the public defender's office since 2003. He's tried close to 100 trials and litigated countless judge trials, hearings, and motions. He's also represented clients in family court, conducted probation hearings, and defended clients in Maryland's district court. He has a whole different layer to bring to us today as we try to figure out how you can be presented with so many clear facts and get the outcome that we actually had. Okay, so one of the things that really blew my mind was just, you know, this whole idea of a man who weighs 125 pounds throwing around a 6,000-pound van. Can we start at that point? Can we just talk about that?
Yeah, so the thing about at stop two that became sort of the recurring story from all of the officers who were there was that Freddie was really angry and was making this police van shake back and forth like violently. It was like a recurring thing that a couple of them said in their statements, but they all said in court. And this was something that was also sort of information that was given to the medical examiner as well. So this was like a, I would say, the sort of standout takeaway from the second stop was that Freddie was violently making this police van shake, which I can't quite wrap my mind around, because those vans are big. They're metal, and they're split down the middle. So he was like a $125, $130. Making it shake back and forth seems kind of crazy to me, and especially since the CCTV footage for that stop noticeably does not show the van shaking at all.
Another thing I wanted to talk about, if Freddie Gray has an arrest record, right? If he's been arrested before, why would this time be such a production?
Yeah.
Why would it be so crazy and so out of the ordinary and his behavior to be so different from a person who's has been in one of these rides before?
He had been arrested, in fact, like before the April 12th, 2015 incident, he'd been arrested at least like, there had been about four times just in this 4 or 5 months prior. And he didn't have any sort of violent history.
So this time he shakes the van.
Yeah.
This is what I want to say. So you've been arrested multiple times, but this time is the day where you decide that you're just not going to go in.
And we know that if it was a pattern or a practice of his, the police wouldn't be afraid to share that with us. They would say, we know this area. We patrol it. We know the people that live there. We know Mr. Gray.
Right.
This is how he does.
Yeah. And they didn't say that. I mean, you know, Officer Porter, we haven't gotten into this too much yet on the podcast, but Officer Porter had kind of referred to a case in the past where Freddie had kicked the glass in a police cruiser before. But the thing is that that wasn't true. Like, I've pulled all of Freddie's arrest records and I see what he's talking about, but he's completely blown it up into something that it's not. And so this idea that Freddie, that this would at all be typical of Freddie's behavior is just not true. Like, he had been arrested before and there's no real record of him being a difficult person to arrest. And the thing is, at this first stop, like, even the arresting officer, Officer Miller, said that Freddie gave up on his own. This idea that he was fighting back against being taken into custody just doesn't jive with his past history or with what witnesses say about those two stops, too.
That's kind of typical in a lot of accounts, I guess you could say, that police will give in court, where there's an end result that you question. You wonder, how did someone end up that way? How did they get chased over that distance? And then when they succumb to the police, it's, oh no, they were peaceful at that point. They didn't give us any lip. And you just think that really is totally inconsistent with everything that you just described leading up to it.
And what do you think that's about?
Well, a lot of the times I think it's some sort of use of force or a violent act that kind of makes an individual peaceful all of a sudden. It's like basic physics. Like, if an object is in motion, it's going to stay in motion until something acts upon it to bring it to rest. And it's oftentimes a lot of force.
So we come across all of this new information week after week. And me personally, as a person who never really had a lot of faith in the system for obvious reasons, how should we go forward as far as believing in this system?
After the results of the trial?
After the results. So even to a person listening to this podcast, say I'm Joe American, right? I just took my apple pie out the oven and I set it on the table next to like my family dinner. And I took my flag down and I put my overalls in the dryer. And then I'm listening to this podcast on every Monday. And then I'm listening to the follow-up interview on every Thursday. And I'm seeing all of the things that the system got wrong, all of the stories that don't match, all of the conflicting narratives, all of these different things that clearly shows how the system got this so wrong. How do I go forward?
It's tough. But the one thing I take from it that's good is that law enforcement was brought to justice. Unfortunately, that's kind of where I part ways with what happened. But in the end, looking at it as a defense attorney, as someone that represents mainly African-American people that are poor in Baltimore, I got to think that if my client was on trial with that level of evidence, that's the result I want. Because if the system doesn't spit it out that way, then none of us have hope. And you just hope that that will inspire the state to do better next time. It'll make everyone a little more vigilant. You know, the level of response in the uprising and the protesting after Freddie Gray's death was tremendous. And, you know, what the state wants is a lull period before they bring stuff into court so that public sentiment dies down. And of course, so then the officers get a fairer trial. But I went to a lot of the court proceedings and followed a lot of the stuff as it went on, and the level of interest was there from the national media, but locally it really died down and the pressure wasn't there as much as it was during the uprising and the protesting.
That's interesting. So you think that like once the trial started local, I mean, I know that the Sun was covering the trials really kind of extensively, but other than that, you felt like interest locally kind of started to die down around the trials?
Yeah, not so much the media, but local. It's tough. I mean, court proceedings are really boring. And the way that you guys do this, the podcast here and portray the case over the episodes, it makes it interesting and compelling and a conspiracy type, you know, motive behind it, which it is. And but you don't see that in court.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to sit and understand. I mean, that's a big thing that I want the justice system to move towards and to be more accessible to people. And it's just not. And I guess that keeps people away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess my first question came from, I remember after the first trial, and Elijah Cummings, he came out and he said, you know, you got to respect the court's decision. Justice was served. He had a fair trial. And I'm like, yo, this is not a fair trial. Like,
yeah, I
fair
mean,
how?
Yeah. I think it's interesting because it presumes that the case that's brought into court was the most just case that could have been brought. And one of the things we're trying to do in this podcast is really look very closely at, well, first of all, what happened to Freddie Gray that day? And then comparing what we find to what case was brought into court against the six officers. And it's been difficult because, you know, on one level, I feel like the officers who were involved are all culpable on some certain level in some sort of way. Some of them, I think, are much more culpable than others based on what we've kind of learned so far. And then some of them, I think, that are less maybe culpable than the charges that were brought against them. And so it makes looking at the state's attorney's case and the trials against the officers much more complex than a sort of like just calling it, you know, was justice served or was justice not served? I don't think justice was served because I don't necessarily believe the case is the best.
Do we have to be so politically correct?
Yeah.
Like when we talk about this? Like, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, obviously, it's not Elijah Cummings' fault. He's not the person that's on trial.
Right.
But come on.
Well, like, right. Yeah. A man died and nobody is being held accountable for
you cut
it.
A water hose. Yeah. Cut a water hose. You can get life.
Yeah.
You break a CVS window. You can get life.
Well, that's the thing.
You kill
I think
a person.
Is,
and it's, you know, it's just we all made a mistake. We didn't mean to, but we're sorry. It wasn't our family member. And it wasn't a person that's part of our community.
Right.
Our community. It's just an on-the-job accident. It's, let it go.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things
like
about this case.
Like they spilled a tray of burgers at McDonald's. It's crazy.
I think that this case has really illuminated the way that cases like this are prosecuted versus the way that cases against people like Freddie are prosecuted and comparing those two. And I think the overall picture is one of no, justice was not served at all across the board.
You may have already given up on your New Year's resolutions. Well, there's one that you can keep with ease. Build your website. A few years ago, I was bombarded with invitations to give lectures, and there was the occasional press interview, so I needed a place where people could learn a little bit about me, check out my writing, my speaking schedule, and the oh-so-important headshot. Then I found Squarespace, and I learned I could build a beautiful website without having to learn to code, worrying about patches, or spending time checking for upgrades. With Squarespace, you can make your next move look beautiful with the easy-to-use, award-winning, all-in-one designer templates. Build your brand, set up your online store, or show off your gorgeous portfolio. Whatever the project, the idea, or business, cross that resolution off your list with help from Squarespace's 24/7 customer support and make your next move in a still pretty new year. Use promo code undisclosed for 10% off your website subscription or domain purchase. Squarespace, make your next move.
So how do you feel when you walk into a courtroom? Do you feel like your client is going to receive justice in our current system?
Not always. I mean, justice is different depending on what courtroom you go to. I mean, and then it depends what day on a certain courtroom. I mean, if someone wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, you could get a bad decision out of a judge. You know, when someone's bail gets set, it could be based on the type of morning that that person had, you know, or an experience that they are going through in their own life. You just don't know what you're going to deal with. And then you get inherent prejudices, assumptions, you know, mistaken beliefs. There's all kinds of stuff. And then I'd say about half of my clients are locked up because they can't make bail or they're held without bail. And then that brings on a whole nother presumption that because you're locked up before your trial, it's assumed that you did something, and it makes representing someone so much harder.
Do they talk about that in court? Like when your client is brought in, if they can't afford to pay their bail, and so they've been in jail until their court date, do they always come in like shackles and stuff too, if that's the case?
Absolutely. Yellow jumpsuits.
So when that happens, is there ever any explanation that's given to like the jury, for example? Like this guy just couldn't afford his bail. It's not that he's guilty based on this.
A jury can't see that.
Okay.
But it's still problematic when you're going through your daily motions and your just procedure to see whether you're getting postponed or going to trial. It's just a person that presents themselves, you know, with a nice shirt or a suit on that's standing next to you unshackled. They just look to be in a better position than someone that's dragged in because they had to wake them up at like 3:30 in the morning to get on the van to come down to court. And they're sitting there half asleep in a yellow jumpsuit, all dirty and smelly. Yeah. That person just doesn't present well to a judge. And that's not who they are in the community.
Right. Yeah.
But for a trial, they can change. They can. And then we go through this whole rigmarole. Like you got to make sure that when they're moving to the courtroom, jurors don't run into them in the hallway. There's always a facade of fairness that they put on.
So do you think Mosby had a chance in this case to convict one, if any, of these police officers?
Not under the theory that they used. It was never happening. I mean, I was really excited to see the indictments come down, but then to hear the theory of the case, it just, I thought it wasn't going to work right away.
I mean, I remember when Mosby announced the charges, and I remember thinking, oh my God, this is incredible. Like, because you just don't see this happening, especially to that degree, six of them all at once.
Now, people were throwing parties here.
I think there are people, though, when they, the next day, a sort of hangover set in and sort of like really sort of taking a look at what the narrative was behind those charges. I think people in Freddie's neighborhood in Sandtown were like, hold on a second. Because they saw something completely different. I mean, Mosby's charges emphasized, for the most part, the van ride. And then when it came to what happened during the arrest and at the second stop, it was much more of a sort of procedural issue, whether or not the chase was justified, whether or not the arrest was justified. It wasn't at all related to the brutality that was alleged by a lot of those witnesses. And so I think, as we sort of said in a couple of our episodes, I mean, people there really believe that Freddie was injured there. Whether his fatal injury was sustained there is something we'll be talking about later in the podcast, because it is complicated. His injury is complicated. But, you know, to me, I completely understand any anger people there feel about the fact that that part of the story was completely omitted from the state's case. And I've never understood that. And this is something I wanted to talk to you about, Todd, because to me, at the very least, those witnesses have accounts to give that I think illustrate the way in which those officers may have been looking at Freddie and treating Freddie like a disregard for his well-being, which is ultimately kind of what the case is about, isn't it? You know? And so I couldn't understand why the state's attorney's office didn't see the value in those witnesses, I guess, at least even to support their own BS narrative.
Because they're not practiced in using civilian witnesses.
Okay, please talk about that. Tell me about that.
They're not. I mean, those are my clients. Yeah. Those are my clients' family members. You know, I'm white. I have a middle-class upbringing, but I've lived in the city now for over 16 years in a black neighborhood. So those are my neighbors. And, you know, they're not used to using that type of a witness. And mainly because a lot of their cases revolve around professional witnesses that are police officers, medical examiners, people that are literally trained and come into court as witnesses. They know the deal. And so right away, you've got someone who's uncomfortable and not used to the system. And their ability to interact with that type of a person is just not there because they're not on our side of things. And then you get criminal records. You get people with records. And there's issues of, so just because you have a record doesn't mean you can't be a witness. And the only thing that would prevent you from being a witness is if you're convicted of perjury, which is just like never happens.
Right.
Even though arguably it occurs routinely from the law enforcement community. But besides that, even if you're a convicted felon, you can testify. And I think we're always scratching and scraping to come up with something to offer as a defense. And if it's a civilian witness that's got a record but tells a good, compelling story, I'm going to use it because I think the story carries the weight over, you know, any kind of prejudice that a jury might see or even a judge. Because judges, I mean, a lot of them get it. So when a witness is on the stand, I would take that risk. And I think the state is hesitant in doing that. And it kind of goes towards trial strategy where they think that they can put their money, not literal money, but they can invest in a professional witness rather than just some person off the street.
Yeah. That's the thing that I found so crazy about this case is that even the, you know, I think of the abundance of witnesses that could have been called civilians just to attest to the ways in which they saw the police treating Freddie. And, you know, it's not like they're all a bunch of like young men who stand on corners and who maybe have like very recent, you know, drug convictions or arrests or anything like that. We were talking about like grandmothers, grandfathers, like, you know, people who to me seem like they'd be great witnesses, like perfect witnesses.
Well, we forget that those are the people that mainly make up the community. It's not a community of criminals. It's,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And that make up juries, you know?
Right.
Yeah. They were all so compelling. And when you really, and the thing that doesn't make sense to me either is that they were all talking to the media. So it's not like these people were like hiding out in their homes and not talking to anybody. Like they were using their first, their last names. They were easy to find. I found them. Didn't take me
so
long.
So what's all the, what's the logic behind not using them? Like the main reason, like if you had to like go into the mind of the people prosecuting this case, why? Like, why not?
Well, with a lot of these decisions, I don't know if it's negligence or deliberate sabotage. And I don't want to, you know, I still have a career in the city and I practice here all the time.
Right.
And I'm willing to participate, but I don't know where, if they just didn't get it. Their experience is so limited. They have what we refer to as the blinders of the righteous. And, you know, sometimes they just can't see out of their prosecutorial box and use these different strategies. You almost need it. And you had this in Bledsoe. She's been in the private defense bar. You know, I used to see her go to trial a lot. I can't speak to how well, but from what I understand, she was very well respected as a criminal defense attorney. So you have that mind in the trial team. I don't understand.
And Janice Bledsoe, so she's one of the prosecutors on the case. She actually, a few years prior, had actually represented Freddie Gray in a case of his. She kind of stepped in when another attorney had to kind of leave the case. So it was a sort of brief period that she represented him, but she was in court with him. He didn't like her very much. I'll say that much. I watched the film of it. It was a little awkward. But yeah, she has experience and she has dealt with clients like that. But I'm with you. I'm still trying to sort of figure out how much of this was incompetence as far as like just not knowing what they were doing with this case, or how much of it was sabotage in the sense that they decided on their narrative and weren't going to deviate from that.
Everybody's supposed to be representing the people.
Yeah.
But the people are always excluded.
Mm-hmm.
How? Like, how is this happening?
Yeah.
Like, I can see if this was like 1865.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If it's 2017 and we're doing the same things over and over again.
Is it a matter maybe of them just being sort of fearful, like they're not going to show up in court?
I don't see how you can't sell the first major trial of law enforcement, you know, bringing to justice this important issue of some of your neighbor and your son that's been killed by the police. I don't see how that wouldn't sell to anyone who wants to testify in this case. It's not a typical retribution type situation. There's nothing. People would be jumping to be the witness. And
yeah, I mean,
the no snitching rule goes out the window
when it comes to cops.
The no snitching rule goes out the window when it comes to cops. People snitch on a cop in a second.
Yeah,
like, that's just not even.
I know that Harold Perry would have been at court. He would have been there early to testify.
And then the no snitching rule goes out the window when it comes time for cops to tell on other cops.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have this conversation about, oh, well, you know, all cops aren't bad, you know, but we never see these cops show up and say, you know, I didn't see many police officers really be extremely vocal about what their fellow officers have done. I followed Baltimore City Police Department on Twitter, and I watched them tweet people, students I used to teach, guys I grew up with. Like, I see them put mugshots on their account all day. But when the six of cops got arrested a couple of weeks ago, I didn't see them post those mugshots and hashtag a safer Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So some of us, do we had to do it for them? Or
they're really investing in the presumption of innocence. You know.
Yeah, now they are.
Yeah,
exactly.
Now they are. Only when they're on this side of it, yeah. It's a total hypocrisy that, especially with the level of charges that were brought against the recently indicted officers. I mean, I know police officers, and they've said to me privately that everyone is totally embarrassed and ashamed, and these guys should get the book thrown at them. But I agree, it's not, you don't see that publicly.
Yeah, that's not enough. It's like, man, guys, you have like guns. Like, can you be brave for once and freaking tweet something in support of the fact that like some of your brothers are acting ridiculous and in criminal ways? Like, you know, nut up.
Yeah, I think, you know, like, if you really want to be serious about police reform, then it's going to have to be, you know, everyone being serious on both sides. You can't just portray one narrative.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing, like, you know, a person to do like 60 racist things and then you call them racist and it's like, no. Oh my God, no, I'm not I'm not that.
It's much worse to be called racist than it is to actually be racist.
It's like, you know, everybody's a great, all cops are great, all cops are heroes, blah, 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 blah. But we see all of these different things happening.
Right.
And then when something finally happens, like, and we're talking about the police officers that were locked up for overtime fraud and
racketeering
and all types of.
Robbing people.
Robbing people. Basically doing everything but their job.
And the thing is, I feel like those guys are the tip of the iceberg. Like, those are the ones that, like, got caught because they were being flagrantly obvious about it.
Because they know the system is trash.
Yeah.
They do.
And this is me. This is not Todd. This is me. This is me. This is very, very clear. They know that they work in a trash system that allows them to basically get away with murder. What is the incentive? You can be president. You can have a campaign full of lies and be president. Why not be a police officer and steal an extra $100,000 a year from the very same trash system that pays for your misconduct trials? I'm talking about Daniel Herschel right now.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Herschel had, what, it was like $250,000, $200,000 in misconduct trials. My tax dollars pay for that. I pay for him to break those arms.
And it didn't look like he even got like demoted ever.
He got reward. He got rewarded.
And we have a template motion in my office where we put together all the press clippings on Herschel. There's a federal judge that actually ordered a couple of the incidents out of his personnel file to be disclosed. Judge Hollander, I believe, did that. So that's part of the attachment. It's one of the thickest motions that I've ever filed. And we've been working with that motion for at least 5 years. So to say that, you know, it's the police department on one level, but it goes deeper than that. I mean, people were on notice of Herschel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his name, There was the issue.
Rings bells throughout the whole city.
The rap community. The rap community knows Daniel Herschel.
There's the rapper guy who had a song about him, right?
I wrote the article about Herschel harassing not just that rapper, but his family. Yeah. He harassed, locked his mother up. Like, he asked him, he said, wait, are you Moose's mother? Oh, yeah, your ass is going to jail. This is his language.
So it goes so deep because we'd make a request to the state. They say, no, we can't. And then the city steps in and their lawyers come and say that's a personnel issue. Then we argue it to the court and they say those aren't things that are admissible during a trial. So, I mean, how many layers of protection do they get?
So you're saying basically the police department knew about what these cops were up to. The state's attorney's office knew. Judges knew.
I'm saying that it's very conceivable. I'm saying what you just said makes a lot of sense.
You have to be blind to not see what's going on.
Yeah, and these levels of protection are there.
Right.
So it's not just the police department because we go through the same rigmarole with different officers. I mean, right now I'm waiting on a motion. I had a trial with three of the convicted officers last March, about a week before they robbed someone. And it was a tough trial because we had a civilian witness with a record who told a compelling story that my client didn't do it. And then these three guys got up and arguably lied. And we lost. And my client's in jail. And now the issue is, do we get a new trial? And we're waiting on that.
Yeah. And meanwhile, he sits in jail, waits.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is not a good place to be.
Yeah.
Especially when you didn't do it.
Yeah.
Especially when you didn't do it, you know?
Yeah, I've never been to jail. I can't imagine what it would be like to go there because I did do something or because I didn't do it. Like, I can't imagine. But I know that it's a reality for a lot of people.
And even worse is that as newer cases that are just getting charged with these officers come in and they get dismissed, I have to explain, well, you're in a slightly different situation because you had a trial.
Right. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Even though it's arguably worse. But
right. Because they're basically dealing with the sort of still outstanding cases that feature these officers first.
Yeah, there's no way that they're going to call these officers to testify because they're in federal prison.
Right.
But at the time, you know, it's like, well, it looks pretty certain that all this activity was occurring.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I was saying earlier that I think it's like the tip of the iceberg. You know, I spend a lot of my time, as I've been working on this Freddie case, just researching various officers, various cases, looking for certain connections to certain people, et cetera. And I mean, I will say that I've stumbled upon at least a couple things or people who I am convinced within the police department, who I am convinced are working some sort of shady fraud criminal angle. I'll pass on some information to you. But like stuff that's like, you know, for example, I'm not gonna say names, but there's a cop I found who I am convinced has been using a alias for policing only prostitution cases and is collecting pay under both names from the city. Like a lot of pay, by the way. Overtime on both.
You guys were debating, I think, on one of the past addendums. You were saying, why would someone want to be a cop? Well, it can be a racket.
Yeah, like their salary, their base level salaries. If you just look at that, you're like, oh, you know, $40,000. I mean, it's a lot of money for a lot of people. But in the kind of grand scheme of things, I would say
that's a lot based on the skill set you need to actually qualify.
Well, yeah, but they can make, I mean, there are so many cops in Baltimore who make double their salary in overtime. I mean, and I don't know for sure. I mean, maybe some of those officers are genuinely working really crazy cases that require a lot of overtime. They're earning their money. But I imagine there are quite a few of them who are not quite doing that and are getting paid a lot.
And we got a question of ones who we say are working crazy cases and earning their money because look at the results. Like, I mean, look at the results. Is Baltimore a better place to live in than it was 10 years ago?
Yeah.
In certain neighborhoods?
Yeah.
Like, even with all the new development, the new construction, like, the murder rate's kind of the same. It's not like it's different.
Has there been any sort of changes to the, what is the murder rate here now? Or, and the unsolved ones?
Last year was what? Like, it was like record high, like 300 and like, well over 300, you know? So it's like, that's like a crack era number. That's not like,
and how many of those are they solving?
Not a passing percentage. I'll just say that.
not enough to celebrate.
You know, so we dump all of this money into policing. Mm-hmm. The police don't get it done, yet we, you know, we spend, so we take money from everywhere else, every other little inch of everything, and we pay for all of these police officers, but they're not getting it done. And yet still, police officers feel a need to get all of this overtime. So we have too many cops because it's not working. So we can say that we overpay for cops. And then we're also overpaying them again with the overtime. Because I feel like if all three of us are police officers, then, you know, it's like, oh, you know, Emil, you got overtime. Todd's like, shit, I'm getting some overtime too. You know what, Todd? Let's go get some overtime.
And I think that there's like there's a certain amount of like, in order to become a cop who's sort of able to make overtime, you have to sort of fall in line, you know? I think there's a little bit of a hierarchy there too. Like if you're a new cop, you have to, and this is also the true for sort of growing up the ranks and becoming detective and stuff. Like there's, I think that's how that sort of like boys club gang like feel sort of sets in.
You gotta pay your dues.
Yeah,
rookie.
You have to pay your dues.
Or you could just go like rogue and just lock some people up and get it instantly. So what does reform look like to you? We throw this word around a lot, but it's like we don't really do a good enough job with like quantifiable goals. You know, we're all like the master of stats and the master of like interpreting what's going on. But what do we need to do? Or not us as people, because, you know, we do our job. We pay taxes. So what does reform look like from the legal
side? The president pays taxes.
For real? Oh, I know. It was that one, that Rachel Maddow report.
Yeah, that 2005. He that's the that one year.
I mean, less than us percentage-wise, but he does.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to start at the beginning of the process with bail. I mean, they're debating that in Annapolis right now, and it's already getting watered down because bail, people look at it superficially and they say, okay, well, yeah, that sucks being held in jail before trial because it could affect the outcome of the case. But it goes so much deeper than that. It, you know, people lose their job, their families get affected, kids get affected, housing, all that happens if you're stuck on a bail. And then you get into the aspects of the case where people plea because they just want to get out. And you think, like, if you're getting offered probation anyways, why did you need to be in jail pre-trial? And then you get the issues of people like Freddie Gray, and you start to wonder, especially all this stuff runs through my mind. So when they're doing like the record rundown during a bail review hearing, and you just hear these charges like CDS, trespassing, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct. And then you might see a felony CDS conviction in there, and you just think, well, it's just a spiral. It's like this same situation over and over again. And I bet, and I'm looking at the case in front of me and thinking, this is a ridiculous case. And I'm just thinking, I wonder if those other ones were the same situation and the police just got taken and now we're here and I can't get the guy out because everyone's saying he has a bad record or she, and it's just a spiral. And so if you start on the front end, you eliminate cash bail and you start working with people and getting them services and help right away, maybe we can start convincing the state to stop prosecuting so many petty offenses. I mean, nobody's saying that violent crime shouldn't be prosecuted and some people don't belong in jail. But the system doesn't work now with the sheer volume of stuff that comes in.
Arresting people on petty drug offenses, but then doing nothing to help them, you know, get treatment if they need it. I mean, you know, I'm thinking about, for example, we haven't quite gotten into this yet on the podcast, but there was a second prisoner who was picked up at the fifth stop and put in the back of the wagon with Freddie. And so the whole reason for his detainment is the guy, well, let's just say they basically were arresting him on a really, really petty drug offense. He was caught with like a little baggie of weed and a couple Suboxone strips. Okay, Suboxone is a drug for treating opiate addiction. So this guy was being picked up for, now maybe he didn't have a prescription for it, but I mean, do we really care? I mean, it's Suboxone. It's so you don't take heroin. It's so you don't take OxyContin. And this guy's being picked up, in theory, was going to be transported to jail, and you know, if this had sort of played out. And would he have been able to take his Suboxone? Maybe not. And would he have come out then craving opiates? Probably. Like, I can imagine that happens quite a bit where you pick up people who have drug problems and end up, when they finally get out of jail, it's so much worse because they have been taken away from any access to the things that may have been helping them before.
Yeah.
It's like, great job.
Yeah, you're supposed to A lot of people do get the prescriptions in jail. I mean, there's a withdrawal period, so people go through all that. But then they do have prescriptions in jail, and they're supposed to release you with a 30-day supply. But after that, you've been cut off from your services. And if you haven't seen your healthcare provider, you know, or if you lose your housing, which was near your healthcare provider, and you don't have transportation, it's a spiral.
Well, right. And why are we punishing for people also for, it's not like they picked them up with heroin. They picked them up with something that, in theory, treats opiate addiction. And so to me, I'm just like, why are these, this is what we are choosing to like go after people for, you know? It seems to me that when you have a unsolved murder rate in Baltimore the way it is, and then you have all the cops on the street that morning were picking up people for little baggies of weed or for running, you're like, well, no wonder nothing gets solved around here.
Because mass arrest is still incentivized.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, and so speaking of that, yeah, wasn't that kind of the case with the racketeering cops that were just picked up? Like, if, you know, the state's attorney's office may have known about them, but weren't they also, weren't their stats really fantastic as well?
Yeah, and I think that might have been why they were allowed to do what they do. And it's also interesting looking at, like, the list of overtime gougers, I guess. The people, I mean, some of these people are, like, 120% overtime. It's typically the same type of officer. It's a knocker. It's a plainclothes, freewheeling officer who roams the city. They don't even really have designated like sectors. Sometimes they'll work an area for a little bit.
That's crazy. No, this is
very true. Like, this is like, yeah.
And they just, I mean, there's no accountability at all. There's no time clock. There's no, and you know, they just see him pulling people and finding guns, you know, God knows how.
They're like editors at large.
That's like me, but with a gun.
Yeah, and you, and with the body camera footage now, it's, I can't decide if it's good or if it's bad. It's both. But it's definitely revealing and disturbing. And, I mean, you really see, I think another level to it is how much courts validate this type of policing, which perpetuates the whole attitude of go out and get them, let me collect my overtime. It's this idea that a pretextual stop is okay as long as the end result is getting a gun or finding something illegal.
I'm going to say that if I'm paying, now I'm going right back into legal citizen mode. If I'm paying taxes and some of that money is going to body cams and some of that money is going to these CCTV cameras and I can see the results, I would rather have that money sent to schools. Mm-hmm. Because you can be murdered on camera and nothing happens. Yeah. You know, or look at all over the country, every time one of these viral police cases happen, you know, how many times have the body cameras accidentally been shut off? Why are you cutting them off? You have one function. Like, they have one function to capture stuff like this. Why? Who are you to turn them off? You know, I know in Eric Garner case, it wasn't a body cam, but someone caught it on cam. But it still, he caught the film. It was very clear.
I would say that footage is going to be far more reliable than, like, sort of guaranteed to be reliable in a way that body camera footage can't necessarily be, simply because one of the things I think we haven't quite necessarily figured out yet with the body camera footage and even with surveillance footage is who is sort of managing that type of digital evidence, you know, before it goes to like prosecutors or if it's even ever released to the public. I mean, you know, with body camera footage, I think in the city, it's going to be going through the police department first, you know, and how is that evidence managed?
That's another thing. Our money, we're paying for edited film, or I'll just say film that appears to have been edited.
Right.
Because, yeah, you know, you guys, you do a great job at explaining it on the episode. If you care to talk about just the differences in between the cameras, how the time was changed.
Yeah, I mean,
or appeared to be changed.
Yeah. There are things about the CCTV footage in this case that are certainly problematic, I think. I'm trying to figure out what the different types of problematic, you know, whether anything has been actually redacted, which is to say like purposely blurred. And there are very good reasons for doing that. There are privacy reasons for doing that. If you're going to be releasing footage to the public, you know, not having random, you know, civilians' car license plate number visible is something to redact, for example. But trying to figure out whether or not there was an additional level of redaction to the overall picture to make it harder to make out certain things. Still trying to figure that out. But you know, looking at that footage and trying to figure out whether or not it's been edited at all. Is there footage that's been cut? I mean, there are things that happened at the first stop for sure, that a lot goes down during that sort of brief period where Freddie is taken into custody. A lot goes down, and none of it manages to show up on even what the sort of state's attorneys and the police say happened is conveniently sort of missing from the footage, let alone what witnesses say happened. And so, you know, there's part of me that's, you know, to me, I look at it and I'm like, well, something has to have been cut. A rotation has to have been cut from that footage. Proving it, though, is extremely difficult. I just had a whole long conversation with a guy from the ACLU about this. And it'll be on a future episode when we're doing a whole CCTV episode, because it's my obsession. But it's difficult to prove. But what's crazy is there are evidence management systems that are used by police officers and by police departments that, on one hand, on the good side, streamline the whole sort of evidence management process, which is good in the sense that a lot of, I think, police departments are very old school and aren't necessarily up to date technologically speaking. But on the other hand, it also does put a lot of capabilities in the hands of people who maybe shouldn't have those capabilities when it comes to that evidence.
Absolutely. It's so strange that we get the most serious evidence in a case in an email. I mean, that's where we are in technology. Obviously, people are going to listen to this podcast by pressing a button. And then it's incumbent on us to figure out how to use this. We get like a special password for each case. And then you got to figure out what files what. We got different audio files and then video files. And then everything has a different player attached to it. You know, the CCTV cameras have their own special player. And then private security footage has its own players. And then they have a special player to take where they have witness statements recorded on it. And it gets confusing. You know, I'm an attorney. I'm no
smart.
Yeah, but that's it. So I struggle with that. And then I have to be looking to see if they really copied it properly. I mean, I can recognize when a date's the wrong date, but we're shorthanded as it is at my office. So it's tough to try to keep up with all of it.
Yeah. I mean, for me to figure out exactly, I still haven't quite figured this out, but you would think that it would be a simple question to be able to find out how does Baltimore police manage the surveillance footage that comes from City Watch. What different what different companies does City Watch have contracts with? Mm-hmm. And that, how do they sort of deliver that evidence to the state's attorneys and to the defense attorneys? And getting a clear answer on that has not been easy. I've definitely have had to talk to both people there, and I've talked to Todd to get sort of his insights. And let's just say that, like, the police here and the state here uses a variety of different vendors for distributing evidence. And it's complicated because each one, like I would want to know what the sort of protocol is in terms of managing that evidence. In each one, I would want an audit for every single one to make sure nothing has been tampered with. But you're too busy to be constantly trying to hunt down those types of things. And, you know, it seems to me that to a certain degree, like, the system is set up to be complicated and confusing so that you can't do that. When I caught my first gun charge, Lord, jugging, running crazy, we was going hard.
Me and B crept down on the boogin, but the gun jammed, so I couldn't. I just want to track back a little bit. How did the police officers involved in Freddie Gray's death get such an easy path to victory? Can we just get just a real clear example on how was everything that happened outside of the van just inadmissible?
Inadmissible?
It wasn't able to be used in court, right? Like, none of the videos, none of the footage.
They could have. So they used the citizen videos, but they used them very sort of, how they used them in each case sort of depended on the officers. And, you know, there was some where, I can't remember exactly who, but there was a couple of the defendants, like, they would air some of the civilian footage, but without the audio.
But most of it was based on an autopsy saying that.
Well, right.
None of the hands-on, if you will, portions that the officers easily could have had with Freddie Gray. There's no video that captures any of that. Yeah. It's all pretty much aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
But some of it is, you know, pre-van footage where he's being dragged.
And he's screaming.
Screaming, limp. So again, there has to be an inference drawn unless you connect the dots by using actual witnesses that say that they saw what happened before those injuries were there.
Right. So, like, on our second episode, on our Stop 2 episode, which just aired this week, you know, we have Brandon Ross's video, which, you know, I find that video so difficult to watch because he's so upset. He is so upset about what he has seen happen to his friend that he, you know, he's able to focus in on the scene behind the van for a little bit, but he otherwise is sort of flailing his hands around. But you can, for the first 20 seconds or so, you get a pretty decent glimpse of Freddie behind the van. This is after they've taken him out and they're going to shackle him. And so Freddie's kind of have his torso part of his body, you can't really see because the officers are in front of him, but he's basically sort of looks to be laying over the rear of the car and kind of into the floor of the wagon. And the rest of his body is on the ground, sort of kneeling on the ground. He's not moving at all. And he's not making any sounds either. And the question is like, you know, to me, if I were a prosecutor, I'd be like, if I wanted to use that material, is like, well, what can we bring in a witness who can talk about what they saw happen before that? And there was a witness, Jacqueline Jackson.
I guess the more clear question, I will scratch the last one. The more clear question would be, other than Porter and then the cases that were thrown out, how did those other officers have such a clear path to victory?
Because I think it was the strategic choice to go with a theory of negligence versus hands-on assault. And then when you divide that over six ways, if I have a client with five co-defendants, you're really dividing the blame up. And then when you have a theory of negligence, like someone didn't do their duty, because they didn't do their duty, Freddie Gray died, it then becomes, whose duty is it? How well did they know the duty? Did everyone really do the duty, you know, on a day-to-day basis? Were they really using seatbelts and putting people in vans under procedure? Are the procedures aren't they normally a joke? I mean, because in my cases, when we try to bring up procedures, this was the most forceful and, I guess, affirmative use by the state of general orders that I had ever heard of, because we usually try to confront cops with them and say, you're not doing your job. This is what's outlined in your procedures. And the state will object to it and say, well, that's not, they have a situational decision to make. And yet in this case, it was just, these are your orders and you didn't stand by them, and you should convict based on that. And so it's this whole theory of trying to prove a negligence case in a serious criminal matter. And there is criminal negligence, but it's a really difficult theory to put forward.
Yeah. And what was interesting was also watching the officers' attorneys basically defend their clients by sort of arguing that, you know, they're poorly trained, that nobody really follows the general orders. And it's bizarre to see the argument in this case where largely came down to, well, nobody seatbelts. Okay, what? Like, that makes it okay? Nobody does it, so it was okay they didn't do it in this case, and it might have led to this guy's death.
And this is what the public struggles understanding. Like, mm-hmm. Nobody does it, so it's okay. So you could just go home. Because if I walk into a store and I, you know, grab a bag of chips and walk out and say, nobody pays. Like, I just, you know, I made a mistake. You know, can I go home? That's not going to be the case. So it's like, I think the public we kind of want some perspective on that.
I agree. I just think that assault sells better than negligence. And I mean, it's a standard. I mean, that if I was defending someone, not a police officer, but, and they're charged with that, with what the state was kind of alleging in this case, and had that level of proof, I wouldn't want to see a conviction.
I feel like I could defend a police officer and get him off. You know, I could just walk in the courtroom, I can go get a suit. A Men's Warehouse.
Yeah.
And then come out my little suit on. And
I mean, that's the thing that's tough about this case is that, you know, as much as there are some of those guys I really felt like needed to be held accountable. And frankly, for not the charges that they were charged with, some of them for much higher charges. But some of them, I sort of, like, God, the evidence was just not there. Like, it just wasn't very good. And the thing is that, like, as a person who wants to see the system work for everybody, that does mean, like, it working for everybody. And in this case, like, there's some of the officers were charged on grounds that, with such weak evidence that I'm like, I kind of get why, you know, it didn't work.
I have a question for you, Dee. If they were convicted, and let's say it was Rice or Nero, so, like someone that had their hands on front, what would an appropriate sentence be? I struggle with that.
Oh, it's easy. Life.
Life.
Yeah, life. You know, they were responsible for his murder. I mean, you know, did they murder him intentionally?
Yeah.
I don't know, because, like, I've had experience with police officers, and a lot of them don't really have a sense of humor. Uh-huh. Like, they just don't. So I think if you take that job, and this is, you know, if you take that job and you take an oath and you're supposed to protect people, and this is a person that you had no clear reason for stopping or harassing or doing anything to, and that person ends up dead, you cost that person his life, you know, you sacrifice yours, and you should be held even more accountable because we pay you for a service. It's how I feel. I feel like, you know, and if you say that in a courtroom or in front of a bunch of police officers, I'll be looked at as radical and crazy and out of control. But I mean, you know, shouldn't police officers be held even more accountable? Because we, like, let's just say we went to church or something, right? You know, and I mess up, you know, I do some bad things that the church wouldn't agree with. If the preacher does the same thing, you're going to look at the preacher a lot worse, because this is the guy who stands in the front with the robe. So they should be held at a higher regard than just the everyday citizen, I think.
If comparatively speaking, you know, Officer Rice being, say, charged with second degree murder or something versus Joe Blow on the street being charged with second degree murder, like same charges, I do think there should be an additional level of charging that comes with its own additional level of sentencing for police officers, in the sense that they are given the duty of protecting people. And in the process of doing that job, they are actually doing the opposite. There should be things like additional sentencing ideas taken into consideration.
Because
you get
to be called. Look at the flip side. The flip side is you don't even have to be good at your job, and you get to be called a hero for the rest of your life. You got to pay for that some way, right? That's a big tag. You get, if you go and you fight in a war or something, and you go through the airport, everybody, or even if you walk through the airport with your police uniform on, people are going to be like, thank you for your service, you know? And you're going to be like, oh, no, it's no, I do it for y'all. It's no problem. So this isn't to take away from, because maybe some people are heroes and they do great things. I haven't met them, but I'm sure they probably exist somewhere. Somebody's, I mean, I'm not even joking. I haven't met them, but I'm sure somewhere there's like a cop pulling a cat out of a tree that's on fire right now. You know, I'm absolutely, but I'm saying that.
I actually found an article that where Herschel did that.
Really?
When I was looking for bad stuff. Can you believe that?
That fucking guy.
Yeah, he found it on Yahoo. It didn't come up in a Google search. It was like a Yahoo.
He lit the tree on fire, actually, and he put the cat up there. He saved it.
This is where Donald Trump walks in through the door and say, fake news. No, but I felt like you get to be a hero, you know, and I'm not even like, you know, people say I'm rough on the cops. That's cool. Maybe I am. But they've been rough on people that look like me longer, like before I was born. So I can be rough on them. So I just say that, you know, you get to be a hero. You get a gun. You get overtime. You know, you get people like me to pay our taxes. Because I don't know if you heard any like me or any other previous episodes, but I don't call police officers ever. Like if you, unless I need an insurance report, if I need an insurance report, then I call them. If you took a gun and beat me over the head with it right now, I'm not gonna call the police. I don't think they're gonna come here and be like, okay, Todd, what does he look like? Like, where is he? You know, let me just get some, okay, red jacket. I don't think that's gonna happen. Anyway, long story short, I think that if you sign up for this job and you get to be a hero and you get upset when somebody critiques or challenges you because you put your life on the line every day, but you're taking somebody's life and you gave no reason. Freddie didn't wave a gun. Freddie didn't wave a knife. If that even was his knife, Freddie, which was legal, Freddie didn't do anything but ran, because that's a part of his own social context. When you see police officers, especially big, heavy ones on bikes coming at you, you run because, you know, they like to beat on you and harass you and all that. So I'm saying that you get that title, you get that badge, you get that salary, you get to be a hero. You kill somebody based on, you know, if it was on purpose or if you're just that stupid, you kill someone, you know, you should go to jail and you should go to real jail, not like play jail. You should go to real jail and you should do, you know, I think they should have got, Rice and Earl should have got like, you know, 25, 50 years apiece. Oh, Jessup, Hagerstown. They should be out there right now. That's where they should be at. But instead, now Marilyn Mosby is being sued for doing her job. Could you speak to that?
Right. She's facing the civil charges.
I'm very critical. I understand that. But I don't like that. I mean.
The suing her?
Yeah, suing her. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I think that she has tremendous discretion and leeway in the way she charges things. And we can pick apart their strategic decisions and their inability to convict, but I don't think it rises to the level of abuse of power. And I think there's so much politics involved in it, and I think that's kind of behind suing her too.
Baltimore's an interesting place. I get the sense that there's a certain level of like weird behind the scenes drama.
So do you think anything's going to come from that, or like do you think they're going to actually win?
No, I don't.
I'm surprised it's gone as far as it has, though.
I think it's so low. It seems like a very, very low thing to do. Like it's almost
it doesn't usually happen.
It's like you got away with doing something really bad. I'll use that language. Mm-hmm. Is this okay with Dennis? you were a part of something that was really bad.
Yes, that had a terrible result.
Terrible result. And fortunately for you, you didn't have to serve any jail time. Now it's like you're taking a victory lap. When I think the most classy thing to do would be to try to mend the wounds that exist within this community. But what you're actually doing is you're doubling down on everything that is what the whole Baltimore uprise was about. You're doubling down on the same mentality, on the same us versus them. We are better. We don't have to protect and serve. We enforce in your neighborhood. You know, it's our way or no way. You know, you're taking a victory lap. I think it's very low. And I think it's evil.
It seems like the goal seems to be more about humiliating her or embarrassing her in some way in her office.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough because race and gender play into the attacks on her. You know, the next election is a factor into it. And
she's rerunning. She's running, right?
I think she's running.
I think she's running.
I don't think there's any question that she's
running.
I understand when I ask people about that, everybody says it's going to be hard to beat her too.
I think
it should. I mean, who else would charge six cops? So one of the guys who we spoke to a previous week, it's basically, you know, that's the conversation that we had. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it's hard for me to just see anyone else in her position doing that.
But is that alone a mark of effectiveness? I mean, yeah, it was a historic act, and it was something that people, I mean, it's not my experience. It's the Black experience and people who have been abused by the police. It resonated, and it needed to be done for those communities. And I mean, that itself, does it make someone an effective prosecutor?
Yes and no. I guess the easiest way to compare it would be like, would you rather have your leg broke or your neck broke? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, it's like, if the cops walk away, it's not effective. But at the same time, the fact that, you know, you sent them to a temporary time of hell, it sent a message to a lot of other police officers. I believe that. And I think that if they weren't charged, we wouldn't. You know, a lot of police officers were on edge when that happened. And some of them are going to be on edge since that has happened. And I think that's a start into moving towards the right direction. And maybe the next person to hold her spot, well, maybe her. Maybe she'll, you know, maybe she'll convict the next round of people who do something that bad, you know.
But if you're doing that on one hand and then your office is totally inefficient and potentially corrupt on the other, does it all wash out?
What do you mean when you say potentially corrupt?
I think we discussed it already. I mean, if there's police officers that are literally committing crimes while the Department of Justice is investigating Baltimore because of what came out of the uprising and Freddie Gray's death, if there's staff members that are running out the door and there's literally no supervision and cases getting dropped and witnesses not being tended to, does the historic feat get washed away?
Yeah. Does the fact that she charged the six officers in the Freddie case make up for the fact that she or her office or people in her office may have been looking away, like turning the other cheek, while the officers who have been recently charged for racketeering were doing what they were doing? If her office is routinely prosecuting people just like Freddie for bullshit, does the fact that she charged the six officers in the Freddie case on kind of a weak-ass narrative that ended up flopping in court make up for all of that other stuff, you know?
So I don't think it makes up for everything, but what I'm saying is that my expectations are so low. I mean, I'm just being honest. I expect nothing. I don't even expect that. I didn't even expect, when I saw those officers got charged, I almost spilt cereal mm-hmm. all over my new sneakers. I was like, oh my God, I spilled the whole bowl of Golden Grand. It blew my mind. So what I'm saying is that my expectations are very, very low. They're very, very low. So the fact that she did that was great to me, because I didn't think it would be done.
Yeah.
As it didn't happen with this Zimmerman clown. And then it didn't happen to Darren Wilson, who just came out and said, you know, he loosely or freely uses the N-word to identify black people. Yeah. So it's like, I don't expect anything from these people. When I look at them, I'd see, you know, like something that I can never be a part of.
Yeah.
No matter how much money I make, no matter how much success, no matter what. Like, I already see something that's just not for me. I know if I walk into that courtroom, I'm not going to be looked at like those police officers when they walked into that courtroom. It's a whole different game. So, you know, so yes, I do agree with what you're saying, but I just feel like the fact that she even did that made a lot of police officers say, hold up, maybe I need to watch how I move, because, you know, even though I can't go to court, or even though I can't be convicted, you know, I could potentially be charged, and I don't want that. So you got to take those little teeny small wins. Because, again, like I said, my expectations are on zero still. I don't expect anything. Like, I just don't. Like, this is, I mean, you know, the slavery went on longer than it was ended. Like, it's not, this is that system that said that was okay. Like, I don't really expect them to say, well, you know what? Let's figure out some ways to treat these Negroes better. Like, I just don't think that's the conversation they have, you know, in the squad cars or when the people who are making the laws. I just don't think they have that conversation, not even the black ones. So it's like, when I see it, I just don't really. So this is why I can, you know, I can say that a really, really small win from, you know, a team that's always going to be losing to me.
I feel like they were, there was,
at least in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Maybe like if I had great, great grandkids or something, it'd be like a little
yeah.
different.
I mean, I look at it and I see, on one hand, I admire her balls so much, and I do. But I also see, God, if she'd just taken a little longer and really, if her office had really sort of investigated on their own, and if they had done that, would they have arrived at charges that were actually potentially winnable?
Well, we got to take the circumstances into consideration too.
Yeah.
The city was all over the place, and
yeah.
well, right,
you know, there
yeah.
was a curfew going on, and people were waiting. So you're right. You're not the only person yeah. to say she moved too fast, but it's like,
well, yeah. The question is like, because the uprising was happening at the same time, it was treading into rioting territory in some areas, and there was definitely pressure to sort of, well, we need to settle down the city, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she was a huge part because there was no leadership coming from anywhere.
Yeah. So that's something that we look at a lot, is how all of that happens.
She became a leader.
She became the leader.
Yeah. That's a very fair way of looking at it, you know. And she wasn't getting a lot of help, let's be honest. It's not like the police department was like aggressively investigating because they really wanted to find out what happened.
They aggressively protected their own.
Yeah.
And then when, again, if you say that, like, you're supposed to acknowledge it, but if you say it, you're saying something that's like, that makes people look at you like you're loopy or something.
Well, hopefully that's what this podcast will do, because we're trying our best to walk through every step of how this investigation came together. What they were telling all of us, what they were telling the public was happening, how they were disclosing information, but then also revealing how they got that information, like how long they had known about certain things, and then why weren't they disclosing them right away. So hopefully sort of building a picture of what the police department did and did not do to really try and find out what happened in this case, or try and find out what they needed to cover up.
Back to you, Todd. I'd like to ask you a question. I'd like to go back to how much time do you think Rice or Nero should have received? I've meant to re-ask you your question a couple of minutes ago, but we just kind of went off on a spiral. Curiously.
It depends how you frame the question. Like, under the theory of negligence, like under this depraved heart murder theory, that the way it went in court, I don't see that as a life case. But I don't have the preconceptions and the history with police that a black person has, and that level of distrust. I'm kind of indifferent. Mm-hmm. So and then at the same time, I don't like the idea of an enhanced or a special law for the police, like you were saying, that they have a special duty and therefore they should be subject to even more time. I don't like that idea with anything. I don't, as weird as it is, I don't support the concept of hate crimes. I don't support enhancements. I just think whenever we move towards more incarceration for anyone, it always falls back on the poor and the oppressed, and it will be used against those populations in some way. So new criminal laws are always never anything I'm in favor of, and even if that would be an offense for the police. So what I'm getting at is, I would say 20 to 30 years.
20 to 30 years.
All right, Todd. Not bad.
20 to 30 years, half in solitary confinement. So, no, it's funny. It's interesting that you would say that because I guess like the reason why I said it the way I said it was because right now, as it stands, they're held less accountable. You feel me? So right now, I feel like they're held less accountable. And I was saying that I think they should be held even more accountable because they get to be paid. I can't get away from this money notion, but they get to be paid to, you know, go around.
I think the thing that also inclines me, although when I really think about what you're saying, Todd, I agree with you because as much as me, you can sort of write laws that seem to be about policing a certain population or a certain type of crime, it does, like as all criminal laws do, ultimately fall the most and ends up being used the most against, again, communities of color, poor people. And that will be the case across the board.
Perfect example when the state's attorney's office lobbied to eliminate the ability to have a judge trial, to try to cut off the option, because that's what a lot of cops do when they come in and get charged, because the concept of going in front of a judge is going to look a lot better than a high-profile case with a jury of citizens from that jurisdiction. So I don't see that as being cut off for just police officers charged, because I had a couple months ago, I had a gun trial and we chose to do it with a judge because of the technical legal issues that were in it. And my client was found not guilty. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have that option and it would have played out in front of a jury, we still might have won, but that wasn't the strategic approach that we decided on.
Right. Yeah.
And there are really good judges. As much as I criticize the bench, I ran against them. There are some good ones, and it's almost like having a jury. And then you get just, it's so silly the way the system works, but you get essentially an added benefit because you haven't taken up everybody's time to pick a jury, and you can move in and out and quickly because it's just you, the state, your client, and the judge.
Right. So what I was going to say is the fact that I think the thing that makes probably you and myself inclined towards wanting to see police officers sort of maybe an additional layer of punishment when they do something on the job that results in somebody's death comes from the fact that, you know, they have a responsibility. They've been given this sort of, they get paid for it, but it's a responsibility to the community. There are people who get to walk around our neighborhoods with guns. and so when they abuse that power, that I think is what.
Well, where do we draw the line then? There's got to be other professions that you would. You know, arguably, it's bad all the time. That's my point.
Like, I've walked around my neighborhood and protected people, and I've never got a check. So maybe it's coming out of a place of bitterness. Like, that kind of like guardian angel type. Yeah. I just didn't have the beret.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just the feeling that, they've been tasked with a certain responsibility. And they definitely do just, you know, I feel like police officers absolutely do just like bathe in the glory of being seen as heroes.
Doctors.
Okay.
Doctors.
So.
Oh, my God. I just read Medical Apartheid. I don't even know if I can even, I might be too biased to even speak on doctors. If you read Medical Apartheid, it's going to make you throw up.
But yeah, the idea of somebody who's sort of tasked with a certain responsibility, then using that sort of privilege of responsibility, like the added benefits that they get from having that responsibility and using it to abuse their power, I guess. The abuse of power level, I think, is what we're talking about here, right? Yeah, that's true. It's
politician.
Yeah.
I think big points we were talking about, reform looks like getting rid of cash bails and just helping officers get a better understanding. Again, it always goes down to a better understanding of or developing a certain amount of respect for the people you actually
has to do with like where, you know, how officers are patrolling neighborhoods. Like, it sounds to me from what I've sort of read, I don't know a ton about this, but like a lot of beat cops now don't really have a beat. Like, they're not part of, they're moving around all the time. They're not from the communities that they're policing. I know that's a big problem here. Most of the police officers live outside of the city. Reflecting the community you come from, caring about that community.
You know the guy at the corner store. You know the trash man to a certain extent, but you never really know the cops beyond, you know, get the F out the corner. So it's like, how do you break down some of those barriers? Or even if it's possible at all. Do they feel like that they can't be effective if they were friendly?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Get that.
I live in a good neighborhood in Edna Gardens, and we have patrol officers that drive through. I've never had an officer say, hey, you know, Anything I need to be, just introduce themselves, or, I mean.
So I live there too.
Oh.
You know, I live right on a line by between there and Waverly. And the police officers, they put a gun on me when I was trying to put my scooter in a garage. And I'm like, yo. And he's like, there's been a lot of break-ins around here. And I'm like, yo, I live here. And then the kid who was like my little brother who I was mentoring, he played on a wire. And his dad is actually a police officer. So he's like, nah, man, we cool. My dad's a cop. And he told him to shut the F up. He was like, yeah, his dad got all upset. And I was like, you know, I was in like, we didn't file like reports and all that. But, you know, the thing that really, really made those officers mad is when we started laughing and said, you guys are just on a power trip. And they just blew up. Like, they got really, really, really upset.
God. I mean, I just feel like also, you know, for their own sakes, like better training.
My neighbor saw the whole thing. I mean, he didn't say, hey, those guys that live here. He looked. He went back in the house and I said, look at this asshole. I said, look at this asshole. He was like,
no butter for you next time you're baking cookies.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, maybe I just got bad luck. Like, it hasn't been my experiences. But you're right. They don't speak. They don't really speak. They don't really say anything. And I don't think Etnor, Waverly's, you know, Waverly's a little rougher than Etnor. You know, but, you know, they're not the best neighborhoods in the city and they're not the worst neighborhoods in the city. And it is a police presence around there, but I don't know any of them.
No. And I got to think, if they're not going to say hi to an average white guy, then I know what he's saying happens.
Yeah. I mean, and even from a policing perspective, you would think it'd be good to know the people
right.
in the neighborhood. You're
I don't even really understand that neighborhood as far as how policing works. I don't really get it because it's like, the whole idea of community policing, is it even realistic? Is it a real thing? Or do cops think they can be effective if they're the same guys who say hello and speak to citizens and have respect?
I don't feel like I know enough about, I mean, I think feel like there are a bunch of different kind of models for community policing and how they would be implemented in different
My only
cities.
Reference for community policing is The Wire. Like, I never actually
yeah.
saw it in real life. It's more
yeah.
like beat the shit out of the community policing.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
This is what I can, like,
I mean, there has to be something better than what's currently happening, for sure.
This reminds me of the witness discussion and how they bought into professional witnesses and cops and people from the department to prove their case. Yet, the lack of community policing becomes so apparent when a police officer takes the witness stand. And there are police officers that were at least brought up in Baltimore. Some of them do live in the city. Most don't, though. But you can pick up right away when you've got a cop that is a Baltimore person versus someone who lives in Harford County. I mean, they come off as a horrible witness who's coming down here to knock heads right away. Versus someone who, there are cops that care and they come off that, you know, as a much better witness.
So you think it would be better to have police officers that live in Baltimore City, like as if it should be some sort of requirement?
Yeah, but it's difficult to do. I mean, they do it in Chicago and they've said that because they do that, they all end up living in one neighborhood and that's essentially become a segregated police neighborhood.
Cop town.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's like a Dunkin' Donuts on every corner. There goes the neighborhood.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think people, anyone that works for the city should live, you know, I think.
Yeah, give those tax dollars to us.
And your overtime. I mean, that's the biggest crime. I think the overtime probably all went to other jurisdictions.
But I mean, you have to, if you live in the community, you naturally care about it more, yeah. you know, and you look at the community as being more than just a bunch of people that you're policing. You see it as, you know, your neighbors. You see it as like your local grocery store. You look at it as your patch of grass that you don't want to see litter in because it's your patch of grass too. And you empathize more with the people who live there as well who are dealing with the same problems that you are. And I think it just naturally creates a more harmonious way of doing the job. And then as a result, I also feel like the policing would be better because if you're making friends in this neighborhood, well, then you wouldn't have to like arrest people and drag them down to the district for, you know, to get intel. You know what I mean? Maybe your neighbor would be like, hey, I heard about this robbery happening, blah, 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 because they know you and they trust you and they know that you have like a mutual interest in keeping the neighborhood safe and clean and all of those things.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept to want to prosecute and, you know, clean the city up, put the bad people in jail, and not even be a part of the community.
Right.
So, you know, you feel strong enough to want to approve it in that respect, but not to give your tax dollars and your residency to the jurisdiction.
Hey, thank you guys for tuning in. This has been another episode of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. I want to thank our guest Todd, and if you can let the people know where they can find you.
I have a Twitter handle. It's at OPP, O-P-P, the number 4, Justice.
And you can find me at D. Watkins World on all forms of social media, and you can find Amelia at XO Amelia. As a reminder to fans, you can participate in the social media discussion with the hashtag Undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle at UndisclosedPod, P-O-D. Thank you and have a blessed day.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks as always to Ernesto and Ryan at Moose House. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Methil Telhan. We want to make sure we thank our sponsor for this week, Squarespace. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music, and the embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 5. Until then.